From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Philippe Gilly, U.S. chief correspondent for Le Figaro. I'm your moderator, Michael Williams, CBS radio contributor. And here are the issues. The Trump administration, making good on one of its signature campaign promises, formally opened the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem. While the event was celebrated by supporters of Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, it sparked renewed violence among Palestinians in Gaza and raised questions about how the peace process would go forward and who would lead it. In a move that was surprising to some and expected by others, North Korea threatened to pull out of scheduled talks with South Korea and the United States. The reversal was reminiscent of similar tactics used by the predecessors of Kim Jong-un and left the Trump administration searching to develop a coherent response to save the negotiations. In a tweet, President Trump announced that he was instructing his administration to assist Chinese tech company ZTE, an apparent contradiction to the administration's stated desire to be tough on China and its trade policies. The announcement came just before scheduled trade talks in Washington with top officials from Beijing, and after a rigorous approval process that revived one of the darkest periods in the history of the American intelligence community, Gina Haspel was confirmed as the new director of the Central Intelligence Agency, the first woman to head the organization. Well, gentlemen, that's a pretty full slate. Let's get started with the embassy opening and the renewed violence in Gaza, the backlash from that particular event. I'm going to start with you, Tom, as our resident historian here, Issues in the News. If you give us some backdrop on the, I want to say, the actual political and the symbolic importance of moving this embassy to this location.
You're right, Michael. It is an enormous symbolic gesture. I mean, if you wanted to be a cynic, you could say this new embassy is really a Potemkin embassy. It's small. It's basically a refurbished U.S. consulate that was already existing. And there will be a big multi-million-dollar embassy built in Jerusalem. But the symbolism and the political impact cannot be denied. It's important for President Trump. The last six or seven American presidents have pledged to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. They've never done it. And every 6 months or 9 months or a year, they send Congress a statement saying, I'm not going to do this. Trump said he would do it, and he did it. And you cannot ignore the reality that he has once again done something that was a campaign promise that he's followed through on. Now, of course, the downside, as we all know, is the violence. And most presidents who did not follow through on their pledges didn't follow through because they feared that such a move would destroy the Middle East peace process and would incite violence. Well, it's too early to know whether this destroys the process, but there has been significant violence already. So this all remains to be seen, but this is very important politically.
And symbolically.
And symbolically for President Trump.
As you say, there has been deadly violence in Gaza with dozens killed, maybe hundreds injured. It's been significant. Given the backlash on this, let's take a step back, Philippe, and who is for this event and why would they be for the moving of this embassy to Jerusalem?
Well, it seems that there is a pretty broad coalition in the United States that is in favor of this because there is this tradition of support to Israel. The argument that you simply recognize a reality on the ground, which is, of course, a valid argument, but I'm surprised by the very one-sided manner that this decision has been carried out. At no point have we heard the U.S. administration saying, for instance, that they would envision one day that East Jerusalem might be also the capital of a Palestinian state. I think it's a question because when you pretend to be an honest broker for a peace deal and that when you say that you have a peace proposition in the making that Jared Kushner, the son-in-law and advisor of the president, is working on, it's very strange that you have the main broker taking one side like this and not even mentioning the other side. And you also notice that Donald Trump seems to be vindicated by the violence because he chose the Israeli side and blaming the Palestinian side for everything that's going wrong in this area, part of the world. And now their violence is entirely put on the responsibility of Hamas. And so he may say, I told you so. We are on the right side of history here. But I think it's a little more complicated than that. And I think it's not a mistake on his part. I think it's deliberate. They want to lower the expectations of the Palestinians. So to force them into some sort of a low-cost peace deal where you can have the Israelis on board much more easily.
Well, you talk about the Hamas as the agent in instigating the violence. As Philippe said, the White House has put forth, I think they actually used the word publicity stunt, as a way to get attention for Hamas. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think that's part of it. But also, the White House has consistently said that Hamas bears 100% of the responsibility for the violence, and that it was manufactured, and it was not only a stunt, but it was a callous calculation by Hamas to have Palestinians die for the cause. And so the White House is unrepentant on this. The other thing that is interesting is that some of the president's closest political and geopolitical allies, of course, have been pushing him for this. One is a prominent Las Vegas casino owner, one of the biggest contributors to the Republican Party, who is a ferocious supporter of Israel, Sheldon Adelson, but also Benjamin Netanyahu, let's not forget. Jared Kushner and Benjamin Netanyahu have known each other since Kushner was a teenager. And so, but I still think this is all more than anything else is a promise made and a promise kept. Because the first thing that President Trump said after this was, I make promises and I keep them. So this is politically, not to mention geopolitically and symbolically, very important. I mean, it's not often that you see the Senate Majority Leader, Democrat Chuck Schumer, supporting something that President Trump has done, and he was strongly supportive of this.
That was an unusual sight there, for sure. So the Middle East peace process, as it were, young Jared Kushner has been tasked with this on his extensive to-do list. Now, in advance or somewhere, who knows where the peace process actually is in terms of a beginning or an end or a middle, but now you have this circumstance thrust into the mix on that one. Philippe, you mentioned the term an honest broker of peace, and I think for decades it's been assumed that there would be trilateral or multilateral discussions that led to Middle East peace led by the United States. In your opinion, is the United States still in a position to be the broker of a peace process in the Middle East? And if not, who steps into the void to fulfill that role?
Well, it's hard to envision the U.S. being an honest broker in the traditional sense and in the traditional setting of the peace process. But I think they want to change the rules of the game. They see a new dynamic in the region. And that's why I think this administration still think that they can play a role in moving some sort of peace process, but a different one. A one where the Sunni Arabs in the area, especially the Gulf monarchies, no longer support the Palestinian cause and play a role in pushing them toward accepting a much lower settlement than what they used to expect. There has been, when the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia came over to the U.S. and he met representatives of the Jewish community in New York, and he told them, as was reported, that Palestinian leadership had missed one opportunity after another, that it was about time that they accept what is offered to them, and if they don't, they just shut up and stop complaining. So I think the Trump administration is playing on this new dynamic, counting on it, to try to settle an agreement that would suit much more Benjamin Netanyahu and probably not very easily accepted in the Palestinian street.
I think you're right. The United States could, I think, in this process, could never really have been called completely impartial. But certainly now it has stepped to a new position and a new sort of balance for any type of peace or ceasefire or any type of new standard for what can be called a political settlement in that region. Let's move on to North Korea, where the North Korean government this week issued a statement threatening to pull out of a planned U.S. summit scheduled for June 12th, which is right around the corner. The talks had raised hopes of many in the international community for peace on the Korean Peninsula, but those talks are now in a state that can be characterized as tenuous at best, I would say. Tom, I'm going to start with you again. What are the issues that prompted the change in this position for North Korea?
Well, I think what really set off the North Koreans, Michael, is that the president's new national security advisor, John Bolton, a longtime hardliner, a man who has in the past has argued that it would be totally within American prerogatives to launch a preemptive military strike against North Korea.
One of the biggest hawks we have.
Exactly. He's a super hawk.
Yeah.
He used to work for Dick Cheney. That's all you need to know about Bolton. But Bolton said in the last several days that the model he envisions for North Korea is the, vis-a-vis the U.S., is the Libyan model. And everybody knows that Muammar Gaddafi was not pressured, but he was urged to give up his nuclear weapons and was told this will be a better life for you and the Libyan people. Well, he gave them up, and a handful of years later, he was dead, shot on the, as I recall, on the hood of an automobile.
Yeah.
And I think that is what raised hackles in Pyongyang. And, of course, it's really interesting. It's another example of how things are always in turmoil in this administration. Within days, the president came out and cut Bolton's legs right out from underneath him. He said, well, that's not the model we're using here. We didn't give Libya any security guarantees, suggesting again that he is willing to give the North Koreans and Kim Jong-un some security guarantees. So that's why I think this is all posturing. And I think that both these leaders need a meeting for different reasons.
I think you're right about that, Philippe. I was going to ask you, but your position is, who needs this meeting more, the North Koreans or Donald Trump?
Well, at this point, I agree with Tom. I think both of them need it as much as the other. About Bolton, you have to wonder, I mean, if that was deliberate, because I cannot imagine that this guy who's been around for quite some time didn't know what he was doing. And so was it an attempt to undermine the chances of holding this summit or its chance of success? That's one of the questions. On the other hand, you have to notice that Kim Jong-un is back. I mean, it was so surprising until now to listen to this kind of openness to denuclearization of the... Of course, he means the whole peninsula and not only his side. But still, in terms, in the form as well as in the substance, in the fact that he is surprising everybody and taking a counter position, that's more the Kim Jong-un that we used to know. I also noticed that Donald Trump reacted with a lot of restraint in this case. I mean, he didn't jump on his Twitter account and react in the type of my nuclear button is bigger than yours.
Right.
He didn't say a word for 24 hours. When he spoke, he said that as far as he was concerned, officially nothing has changed. And so that shows, as Thomas said, that they very much want this meeting, and I think it will happen as well.
As the president often says, we'll see what happens. Yeah. We'll get back to the issues in just a moment. Here's a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, Current Affairs with Carol Castile. Now back to our panel, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and Philippe Gilly, U.S. Chief Correspondent of Le Figaro. And I'm your moderator, Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor. I guess we can sort of wrap on the North Korean thing. And Tom, unless you had another point that you wanted to make.
Just to say very quickly, I agree with Philippe totally. Both these leaders need this summit. President Trump needs to show that he can play on the world stage in what some people call the big boys club. And he's convinced that he can make some progress here where other presidents have failed. Kim Jong-un craves international attention. I mean, this is, if I were writing for a tabloid newspaper, which I'm not, I would describe this as the I Am Somebody summit versus the I Am the Greatest summit, because Kim wants to show the world I am somebody. And President Trump wants to show, as Muhammad Ali used to say, I'm the greatest. He was asked the other day about trade policy, and he said, well, you've got to realize that in situations like this where you've got to have people who know an awful lot about the issue, like me.
Great. And so, there's never been anyone better than me,
doing it. Yeah. So this is important. I would be shocked if this summit doesn't happen.
Well, it definitely, I believe, is something that's important to both sides. Certainly, if this does happen and peace and denuclearization does come to the peninsula, it is an accomplishment worthy of praise for all considered, for all sides involved. Let's move to the ZTE tweet and the China trade talks. President Trump sent out the following tweet this week that raised eyebrows, including mine, supporting U.S. help for a company that has been accused of spying on U.S. entities. The tweet said, President Xi of China and I, President Trump are working together to give massive Chinese phone company ZTE a way to get back into business fast. Too many jobs in China lost. Commerce Department has been instructed to get it done. After some consternation, both in the press and in his own administration, the president sent out this tweet. ZTE, the large Chinese phone company, buys a big percentage of individual parts from U.S. companies. This is also reflective of the larger trade deal we are negotiating with China and my personal relationship with President Xi. Look, there have been any number of other tweets and statements by way of explanation of this. But Philippe, I'll go to you first. What is actually the position with Donald Trump and the administration when it comes to ZTE? And what is that relationship with the overall strategy of Chinese trade negotiations?
Well, we have to acknowledge that this is very odd. It runs against every position that this president has taken in terms of America first, I'm tough on trade negotiations. I mean, this is very strange, especially for a company. There are three main complaints against ZTE. One is that they have violated every U.S. embargo against so-called rogue states, be it Iran, North Korea, Syria, or Cuba.
It's been a bad actor all over the world.
Right.
For years.
The second complaint is that they lied a lot, because President Obama in 2016 already made a gesture and waived the same kind of punishment by just applying a big fine of $1.2 billion, but still. And then they realized that the managers of this company that were supposed to be punished were, in fact, got a bonus and a raise. And the third reason, of course, is that this company has been branded by the FBI, but also the Intelligence Committee in the House as a threat for the U.S. national security, because they are suspected to use what they build, the electronics they produce, as a spying devices. So you have this president who is supposed to put America first. So what can be the reason? Maybe it's to change the atmosphere of the trade negotiation. Maybe it's to please the American companies that sell a lot of components to ZTE. Maybe, as you mentioned, it is to make a nice gesture to President Xi of China, ahead of the trade negotiation and the summit with North Korea. I mean, I don't have the definite answer to that.
Yeah, we're still looking for that. And it's always fascinating to me to look at when the president chooses to use carrots and when he chooses to use sticks. And the size of those carrots and sticks is also a subject for concern. Tom, any news for you on what that motivation might have been in light of there was a report that a deal with a Chinese company that would have benefited a Trump holding was executed not too long before this announcement about ZTE. Could that have been
let's all remember that the title of Donald Trump's autobiography was The Art of the Deal.
Right.
He's looking for a deal. He's been raging for 2 years that China has taken the pants off of the United States in trade negotiations. He's really upset. The president is upset about the huge trade imbalance. So he's saying, Let's make a deal here. You know, you want a little help here with ZTE. I want a little here, and hopefully that will happen. It's interesting though, because the White House had to scale back immediately. But usually in President Trump's tweets, he's telling you the truth about what he really thinks. He said, "I've told the Commerce Department to get it done." Well, the next day, the White House put a statement saying the president asked the Commerce Secretary, an old friend of his, Wilbur Ross, to look into this. And so he's going to look into this. But I think the order was, in fact, get it done. We need to do this. But very strange.
Maybe he got a deal already in the form of this Chinese investment, $500 million in an Indonesian theme park where there will be a Trump hotel and
golf course.
And golf course, right. So you never know with this president.
You don't know. And we've had, again, this whole situation where every other president has put their holdings into a blind trust in order to comply with emoluments rules about enriching a sitting president. They've been very careful about this. President has chosen not to follow those rules. He also has his inner family sort of traipsing the globe and doing monetary deals at the same time that they're executing policy. So, I mean, given that fact, is there any way to really have transparency when it comes to something like this? And it's kind of not clear as to what the motivation is.
If there is a deal that helps ZTE, it's going to be hard to prove that it wasn't something going on here.
There isn't. And again, it sort of follows the theme. If not, it's not to be proven that there's actual corruption going on here, but there's the whiff of these types of things. And does it damage the president with his base at any point when these types of things happen over and over again?
It doesn't seem it does. His base is ready to accept anything this president is doing. And it hasn't changed from the time when he was elected. When you travel in the country and talk to the people supporting Trump, they support him whatever he does.
It just really doesn't matter to the...
It doesn't matter. They don't believe you if you pretend that maybe it's not that clear how he behaves. I mean, objectively, you have to notice that the agreement they took at the beginning was not considered as satisfying by experts, ethics, umpires, if you want. But they had promised not to do any more foreign deal. That was very clear, very simple.
Right.
And that hasn't been kept.
That has not been kept in any way, I would say. And again, the trade negotiations are going on. President Trump has already sort of proactively said that they may not be successful. Again, whether that's a carrot or stick, we don't know, but we will find out. Very quickly, as we finish, we just got a couple of minutes. I'd like to touch on the fact that Gina Haspel, the president's nominee for head director of the CIA, was confirmed this week, confirmed as the first female head of the CIA. And she overcame objections regarding her participation in the enhanced interrogation programs, also known as torture, that happened some years ago. Tom, real quickly, how did she overcome these objections? Because they were severe.
I think what turned the tide for her, Michael, is she sent a letter. She put it on paper. Her views about the torture, the alleged torture program in previous administrations. And she said in a letter to Senator Mark Warner, the ranking Democrat on the committee, that she did not believe this was appropriate and the CIA should not have done these activities. And I think that really turned the tide. I mean, her confirmation hearing, she waffled and she wandered and she wavered and she wiggled. And there was a lot of wiggle room. And so I think when she sent this letter to Warner and said in writing, not only, as she had said before, that she would not institute a program like this, but that it was wrong for the CIA to have done this, that, I think, sealed the deal.
Yeah, I want to say that we know very, very little still about Gina Haspel, because for two reasons, I think. First, she's the one who decided what to declassify about her own career. And that was very little. We just know she had 20 different postings, 7 of them abroad. So the senators had only the black site, the CIA black site's issue to discuss about her. And what we missed in the end after these auditions is her opinion about anything else. We don't know what she thinks about the threats facing the United States, like Iran, like Russia. We don't know a thing about that because everything was focused on the very limited part of her career that was put in front of the public.
I think that's a very good point. The process itself, though, did bring up a very painful period in American history, I think. It's worth noting that President Trump has said on many occasions that he favors torture as a part of interrogation processes. And in that letter that you referred to, Tom, Gina Haspel said that if asked, she would refuse such a policy because it is no longer legal. And we can only hope that that would be the case for her or anyone else in that position. That is, unfortunately, all the time we have for today. Thanks to Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and Philippe Gilly, U.S. chief correspondent for Le Figaro. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And I'm Michael Williams, CBS radio contributor in Washington. Thanks for listening.
from